zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on Earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the US has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the US has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the US, the military-industrial complex.
The US has tried to be on the first hand, with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby US wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the US seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The US has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the US military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the US no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the US isn't necessarily in wars. It is in fact in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the US. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and US foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
When you think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, US is an interventioning power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different reason, campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong. And it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country, two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Emmet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
تو جلد 43 بحر الانوار روایت هست که خداوند متعال وقتی دور حضرت
In volume 43 of the book Bihar al-Anwar by Allama Majlisi we read when Allah created the light of Hazrat Fatima az-Zahra all the angels were shocked by the radiance of her light. The angels asked Allah about the nature of this light and Allah answered, The light of Fatima is from my light and her greatness is from my greatness. I put my light in the progeny of my last prophet who is the best among my messengers.
بعد خدا متعال فرمود اخرج منه انوار الائمه
Then Allah continues, truly the light of the infallible Imams is taken from the light of Fatima. In better words, Hazrat Fatima az-Zahra is the path of mercy and blessing between Allah and the other infallibles. In the same context, Imam Hassan al-Askari states, We, Imams, are the proofs of Allah on earth, and our mother, Hazrat Fatima az-Zahra, is the proof of Allah upon us. This shows the great status of Hazrat Fatima az-Zahra. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Following Israeli regime's recent savage attack on Gaza, the last two Tory candidates for PM are out-competing each other in supporting it, says Jonathan Cook, author, in an article published under the heading, Contenders for Boris Johnson's Crown Stress Fealty to Israeli Regime. Here's the story. As the Zionist regime unleashed a surprise wave of airstrikes on Gaza recently, the two remaining conservative politicians vying to replace disgraced Prime Minister Boris Johnson publicized letters vowing fealty to the Israeli regime. Their timing underscored the degree to which British politicians on both sides of the aisle have now joined their American counterparts in making commitment to the Zionist regime, a defining issue in their campaigns for highest office. Liz Truss, the foreign secretary, and Rishi Sunak, the chancellor, trumpeted their pro-Israel credentials over the weekend as the Zionist regime killed 45 Palestinians, including 16 children, and injured hundreds more. As expected, Western leaders came out solidly in support of the Israeli regime, even though on this occasion there was not even the pretense that the Israeli regime was retaliating for rockets fired out of Gaza. The Zionist regime initiated the hostilities, claiming its strikes were meant to prevent an alleged attack by the Palestinian resistance group with an anti-tank missile. One can imagine how politicians in the United States and Europe would have reacted had a Palestinian faction justified firing rockets into the occupied territories, unprovoked on the basis that it wished to deter future Israeli regime airstrikes. But in any case, if deterrence really was the Zionist regime's aim, its attack had precisely the opposite effect. In fact, it is never mentioned by Western politicians or media, Palestinians, unlike the Zionist regime, actually have a right in international law to resist the Zionist regime militarily, and not only because the Israeli regime has been belligerently occupying their lands for decades. The Israeli regime has additionally subjected Gaza to a 15-year blockade that has tightly controlled who and what is allowed in and out of the tiny, heavily overcrowded coastal enclave. Gaza has been left in ruins by a series of Israeli regime attacks over more than a decade, what the Israeli regime army calls mowing the lawn. Gaza's trapped 2.1 million inhabitants suffer serious shortages of food, clean water, medicines, and electricity. Malnutrition and poverty are endemic. Last year, the head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, observed, "If there is a hell on earth, it is the lives of children in Gaza. That hell is entirely man-made by the fake regime of Israel." We'll be right back. Perhaps the most flagrantly hypocritical comments on the recent events came from Ivan Kornichuk, the Ukrainian ambassador to the Zionist regime. He tweeted out a message of support for the Israeli regime that turned reality on its head. But it was the Israeli regime that initiated the attack, not the Palestinians. And it was women and children in Gaza, not in the occupied territories, who died under Israeli bombs. His comments serve to underscore the wider hypocrisy of Western politicians, who for years have either minimized or supported the Zionist regime's regular aggression against Gaza. The double standard was starkly evident in the case of the two contenders for Johnson's crown. Recently, Truss and Sunak laid out their unwavering support for the Zionist regime at the very moment it was killing Palestinian civilians in Gaza. They did so to their party's main pro-Israel lobby group, the Conservative Friends of Israel, or CFI. Truss averred, "The UK should stand side by side with Israel now and well into the future. As Prime Minister, I would be at the forefront of this mission," unquote. Comments from Truss, the bookmaker's favorite, particularly stick in the craw. Truss government has increased arms sales to the Israeli regime, to record levels, even as the Israeli regime chucks Gaza and Jewish settlers in the West Bank and East Al-Quds still ever more Palestinian land. It is also unthinkable that Truss would agree to freeze Israeli regime assets in the UK and use them to help reconstruct long-suffering Gaza, or that she would back Britain's going to fight with the Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime's suffocating blockade of Gaza. More than a decade ago, an investigation by Channel 4 described CFI as by far Britain's most powerful pro-Israel lobbying group. Its members were reported to have donated more than £10 million to the party between 2001 and 2009. Which may explain why Truss wrote in her letter, "CFI members are some of our most valued, passionate, and committed supporters. I have no doubt that the strength of the Conservative Party's support for the State of Israel stems in large part from the important role that you all play," unquote. That sounds a little too much like an admission that the Tory party's and her own unconditional backing for the Israeli regime derives, at least in part, from the financial leverage exerted by wealthy pro-Israel donors. It was almost as an afterthought that Truss noted her commitment to the Israeli regime was also because it is the right thing to do. As Truss and Sunak face separate hussings organized by CFI over the next few days, the pair will be encouraged to outcompete each other in demonstrating their loyalty to the fake regime of Israel. That said, it is hard to imagine what more they can offer. Truss strongly hints that she wants to follow the example set by former US President Donald Trump and move the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds in defiance of international law. Peace talks that the Israeli regime has long stymied are premised on Palestinians receiving occupied East Al-Quds as the capital of the future Palestinian state. The Zionist regime has been actively preempting that possibility by helping Jewish settlers take over Palestinian lands in the city and making life ever harder for the Palestinian population there to drive them out. Truss said she had been holding conversations about where the embassy is sited with Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who approved the latest attacks on Gaza, backed Trump's relocation of the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds in 2018. For Trump, the move was intended to pander to his electoral base of U.S. evangelicals. They wish to shore up Jewish control of the region to bring about an end times in which Christians alone rise to be with God, as they claim. Now Truss appears ready to emulate Trump. In her letter, the foreign minister also promises to cement Britain's ties with the Israeli regime by expediting a free trade agreement being drafted by the government. Truss has said closer trade is a priority. Human rights groups like Amnesty International have warned against Britain hastily negotiating such an agreement, warning that it may incentivize Israel's system of apartheid, help the Israeli regime expand its illegal settlements, and give a stamp of approval to Israeli regime efforts to annex Palestinian land under occupation. Truss vows, too, a further crackdown on the international boycott movement backing a U.S.-style bill to prevent public bodies, including local councils, from joining the BDS campaign to divest funds from the Israeli regime for its illegal activities in the occupied territories. She says BDS causes needless division. Presumably, the division that concerns her is antagonizing the Israeli regime's aggressive lobbyists in the UK, not fueling tensions with Palestinians, their supporters, and human rights groups. Given inaction by Western governments, solidarity expressed through boycotts is effectively the only non-violent way for individuals and organizations to punish the fake regime of Israel, whether for its continuing crimes against ordinary Palestinians or its efforts to steal and colonize their land, or its moves to frustrate the emergence of a Palestinian state. By outlawing peaceful resistance to the Israeli regime's belligerent occupation, Truss would leave Palestinians and their supporters with a stark choice: either promote violent forms of resistance or sit quietly while the Israeli regime inflicts death by a thousand cuts on Palestinian statehood and by any hopes of peace. Truss makes clear that she will characterize any effort to hold the Israeli regime to account as anti-Semitism. She intends to silence criticism of the Israeli regime for its human rights abuses at the United Nations, one of the very few international forums where the Israeli regime faces scrutiny. The truth, as illustrated by these bipartisan double standards, is that no UK party leader is prepared to found their foreign policy on genuine ethical principles or humanitarianism, whatever they claim. Their knee-jerk support for the Israeli regime follows from a recognition of global power dynamics. Western neocolonial interests are what sets the agenda in the oil-rich, conflict-prone West Asia region, a region where the super-powerful lobbies of the fossil fuel industry and the arms manufacturers have so much at stake financially. It is those narrow, cynical elite interests that British governments serve, not some notion of the greater public good, which is why the Israeli regime knows it is free to pound Gaza whenever it chooses, with no consequences except for the Palestinians facing its bombs.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the frankness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, we're talking about the frankness of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. Among the very special characteristics of the father of the martyrs is frankness in speech and his outspoken nature. Al-Imam Hussein, during his life, he never resorted to uncouth behavior and he never used deception and fraud and did not make up any deviated path. Rather, he chose the straight path, which was compatible with his living conscience. He avoided every kind of wavering and religion, and good manners do not accept. Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam chose the straight path, which was compatible with his living conscience, avoided every kind of wavering that religion and good manners do not accept. Among the prominent examples of his excellent manners is that when Walid, who was the governor of Medina at the time, summoned him in the dark of the night and informed him about the death of Muawiyah and asked him to pledge allegiance to Yazid, the holy Imam alayhi salam refused. He refused this and he refused and he spoke up clearly explaining his stance. He said, "O Amir, we are the Ahlul Bayt of prophethood and repositories of messengership. The Almighty Allah has initiated creation, has and will terminate it with us. Yazid is a transgression and a sinner who imbibes alcohol," that means he drinks alcohol, "and a man who sheds blood. He openly resorts to sinful activities. None like me will never pledge allegiance to Yazid." These are the words of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam, saying it directly, frankly, that I am not going to pay allegiance to Yazid. Why? Because he went straight by saying that Yazid was a very bad ruler of the time. Yazid was a sinner. Yazid was drinking alcohol at the time. He shed a lot of blood. He never, not the type of Imam Hussein, will never pay allegiance or pledge to someone like Yazid. So this was show the frankness and the outspoken nature of His Eminence, Al-Imam Hussein, and the words demonstrate his strength and determination in the path of truth.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. And in today's lesson, we are talking about the frankness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. He used to speak frankly. He used to say it directly. He never changed his word. Whenever he felt something should be said, he said it. And one of the main examples was when he said directly to the face of Muawiyah that I am never going to pay my allegiance or my pledge to Yazid. Why? Because Yazid is not a good ruler. Yazid is a bad person. Yazid is drinking alcohol. He's a sinner. He sheds a lot of blood. And he said this directly to them. This shows how frank Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam was at his time. So among the aspects of his frankness was that it had become a part of his personality, such that when he was leaving for Iraq, he received the news of assassination of his emissary, Muslim bin Aqil. He sent Muslim bin Aqil was among his messengers, and the Imam Hussein received the news of the assassination of this particular personality, and he's being betrayed by the Kufaitis, the people of Kufa. He told the people who were accompanying him for material gains only, "Our supporters have betrayed us. Thus, anyone among you who desires to go back may do so. No fealty shall remain on his neck." So Imam Hussein was frank and directly faced these people and told them that we've been betrayed. Whoever feels that he desired to go back, he doesn't want to continue with this journey, can go back. I should not lie to him that everything is going to be okay. No, everything is not going to be okay. He should be ready to face a very hard time that is coming in front of us. These particular words, these particular short speeches that Imam Hussein used to give at the time to his people show directly that he was a frank person. He was a frank leader. He was a leader who spoke his word openly, and he never said anything less. Whenever he felt that something should be said, he said it directly in front of the people. He was frank, and this is something that we need to be studying from him. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until next episode, inshallah. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN-Call-of-Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence, feel the air.
In the limelight.
To avoid sanctions, countries are actively reopening moribund routes and creating greater connectivity across Asia. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by James M. Dorsey Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "Russia Sanctions Are Sparing the New Silk Road." Here's more. When the crisis erupted in Eastern Europe, Russia took itself off the map of Eurasian transport corridors linking China and Europe. At the same time, it breathed new life into moribund routes that would allow goods to travel across the Eurasian landmass without traversing Russia. It also opened the door to greater Russian connectivity with the West Asia, South and Southeast Asia regions. Next month's summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in the Uzbek Ancient Silk Road trading hub of Samarkand could provide a linchpin for alternative routes. The SCO, which groups China, Russia, India, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Tajikistan, is certain to set the scene for an expansion to the West Asia region, as well as agreement on the construction of a crucial Central Asian railroad. The summit is expected to finalize Iranian SCO membership. The summit will further welcome Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Egypt, Bahrain, and the Maldives as dialogue partners, and Azerbaijan and Armenia as observers. The United Arab Emirates has recently also expressed interest in an association with the group. Kyrgyz officials believe that leaders of the Central Asian nation and China have agreed to sign an accord at the summit to build a 523-kilometer China-Kyrgyzstan-Uzbekistan railway that has been on the drawing board for 25 years. The railway would link the three countries with Turkey, Iran, and Central and Eastern Europe. Lack of political will coupled with logistical and technical obstacles, particularly in mountainous Kyrgyzstan, and the high cost caused delays that now appear to be perceived as less problematic because of the fallout of the crisis in Eastern Europe. Uzbek President Shavkat Mirziyoyev predicted that the railway would open new opportunities for transport corridors linking the region with markets in the Pacific Ocean area. The move will add to the widening of existing railway routes connecting east with the west. Uzbekistan has long asserted that the railway would offer the shortest route from China to markets in the West Asia region and Europe, while China sees it as a way of evading the risk of violating U.S. and European sanctions that continued transport through Russia could invoke. The new railway would feed into the rail line connecting Uzbekistan to Turkmenistan's Turkmenbashi International Seaport on the Caspian Sea. From there, it can feed into the Caucasus, Turkey, and the Black Sea via the Azerbaijani port of Baku or Iran, India, the Persian Gulf, the East Africa, through the International North-South Transportation Corridor or INSTC that makes use of the Iranian port of Anzali and potentially Chabahar. The INSTC, a 7,200-kilometer patchwork of independently operated railroads, highways, and maritime routes, also provides a corridor northward to Kazakhstan and Russia. Earlier this year, Iran and Qatar announced regular shipping lines between the two countries as part of the INSTC. Similarly, Iran's Ports and Maritime Organization, PMO, announced the launch of shipping lines between Chabahar and Dubai's Jebel Ali port. Chinese analysts also expect that the railroad, which would start in Kashgar, will help transform the economy of Xinjiang.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ali on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alaiha. Gabriel would inform Fatima al-Zahra about the Prophet's position with God the Merciful and his high status. He would tell her about the events that were to unfold for her children in the future. He would tell her about the things that would happen to Imam Hassan and the events of Karbala, the events that would happen to the other Imams, peace be upon them, and about the life of the Imam of the time, Ajjalallahu ta'ala faraju sharif. And the commander of the faithful would write these down. This is a very important matter. According to the Holy Quran, Gabriel descended upon someone other than the Prophet only once in history. Then we sent to her our spirit, and he appeared to her a well-made man. The Holy Quran, Surah 19, verse 17.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the Arabic word ruh, soul, refers to Gabriel, there is some disagreement about this. In the story of Mary, the exalted God has only sent Gabriel to someone other than a prophet just once. Of course, other angels have frequently descended upon people, but Gabriel only one time. But in the case of Lady Zahra, the discussion isn't about him descending one or two times on her. Gabriel would visit her frequently and show his respect to Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. The Holy Quran speaks about Lady Fatima in the chapter The Man, Al-Insan, in the verse of purification, Tathir, and in the verse of Mubahila. These are verses that almost explicitly speak about Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. There are also verses that indirectly refer to that great personality as well. This is a very important point that the exalted God speaks about Fatima al-Zahra's actions and those of her family in the chapter Al-Insan. This is a flag that the Holy Quran raises up and places on the door of the house of Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. We only feed you for Allah's sake. We desire from you neither reward nor thanks. The Holy Quran, Surah 76, verse 9. These personalities work for God, are sincere, show purity and offer selfless services. To whom? To orphans, to the needy and to captives.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Kashmir is decorated with Indian flags as India is marking its 75th Independence Day anniversary. Government offices, schools, colleges, official vehicles, roads and streets in and around Kashmir were decorated with the Indian flag as part of a government-led nationwide campaign dubbed Tricolor in Every Home. In Srinagar's Sher-e Kashmir Stadium, Kashmir's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the Indian tricolor in the presence of government officials.
A new dawn of hopes and dreams is here. Since August 2019, the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is scripting history and is recording unprecedented performance in every sector.
The administration in Kashmir took stringent security measures to ensure a smooth flag hoisting ceremony. Barbed wires were stretched across roads, guarded by security forces to avoid the breach of security or any militant attack. Shops and business establishments were closed and traffic remained largely suspended. But prominent politicians in Kashmir say holding such celebrations in Kashmir only hurts the sentiments of the people of Kashmir and is just rubbing salt in the wounds after what they call India's illegal move of scrapping Kashmir's special status on August 5, 2019.
Post-abrogation of Article 317, New Delhi has not been fair to the people of Kashmir. It was a death of democracy. People's wishes and aspirations were not considered. The unfurling of the tricolor in the city center by a handful of people amid tough security is not what we call normality. If it was normal, people would have participated in large numbers, and this is what the government of India needs to address.
He added, in the absence of political process, people of Kashmir seem to have lost all rights and have been silenced. The decisions are taken without taking people on board.
On August 5, 2019, New Delhi abrogated Kashmir's special status and divided the region into two parts, calling it integrating the region with the rest of India. Experts say if India wants to win over the hearts of Kashmiri people, instead of imposing decisions, India must start addressing the concerns of people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Meet Rira, the latest crossover car produced by Iran's giant automaker, Iran Khodro. The vehicle was unveiled at Iran Khodro's factory, west of Tehran. The Iranian automaker says this is the first crossover ever built in Iran, which can compete with international rivals. Iranian automakers, namely Iran Khodro and Saipa, have picked up the slack after Francis Peugeot and Renault, along with other international automotive companies, exited Iran in 2018, in the wake of U.S. sanctions on Tehran that created a supply crunch, pushing car prices to unprecedented highs. The crisis forced Iranian companies to produce Iranian-made vehicles. While admitting the adverse effects of U.S. sanctions, Iran Khodro Managing Director Mehdi Khatibi said the measures have had their silver lining.
We don't agree with sanctions. We favor free international trade. However, sanctions helped us become an automaker, and today I should tell you that Iran Khodro is a respectable and reliable car producer in the world.
Iranian-made cars already roll on the streets of countries such as Iraq, Syria, Azerbaijan and Senegal. However, Iran Khodro has higher ambitions, planning to export 100,000 cars each year.
In Turkmenistan, we have exported our buses. Our new market will be North Africa, especially Tunisia, where we have already presented our Rona model. We will also resume exporting to Venezuela and Armenia. And all this have come despite U.S. sanctions.
Launched in 1966, Iran Khodro Industrial Group, or shortly IKCO, started by producing the first Iranian-made